Hello, I'm Guy Foster, and in this episode of the Brewin Podcast, we're going to be trying to catch listeners up on the unfolding Brexit drama, courtesy of our head of strategy, Paul Dannis. But bear in mind, we can't guarantee sources from outside Brewin Dolphin. Tax legislation and allowances can change. And remember that when investing your capital is at risk, investment values can increase or decrease because of currency fluctuations, and future performance can differ from that of the past. So now let's allow Paul to let us know how close we are to a resolution of the dominant issue in UK politics, economics, and to some extent, even investments. On with the show. Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to another Brewin podcast. And we're going to attempt to deal with the very rapidly changing situation as we approach the end of the transition period and the eventual sort of crystallisation of Britain's departure from the European Union. And we're going to do that with the help of our head of strategy, Paul Dannis. So, Paul, welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks, Guy.
Okay, so we're going to kind of hit you with some rapid fire questions, really, to try and cover this. And so I think just to start off with, like, if you could set the scene, where are we now as we record this in terms of the negotiations on this departure?
Well, the Sunday deadline has come and gone, and we're at Monday, the 14th of December now. And then fishing dispute resolution and level playing field negotiations, they remain the key points of contention. There's still the negotiating table. British negotiators are now saying that they can go up until Christmas. But, you know, it's difficult to say what the actual deadline is. The two sides have breached these deadlines so many times in the past, but it's obviously getting down to the wire as the transition phase will end in 2.5 weeks.
Okay, and so a simple one then, will there be a deal?
Yeah, easy one to answer. Well, I mean, optimism around a deal has fluctuated pretty wildly over the last week. So last Tuesday, optimism on chances of a deal increased when an agreement was made around the implementation of the Irish Protocol. Then it dropped after the Wednesday dinner in Brussels when it was clear that both sides remained far apart on the key issues. Then, you know, as of today, optimism's increased again after a reportedly constructive call yesterday between the Prime Minister and Ursula von der Leyen. So it's a tough call, but there's probably a slightly greater chance of a deal than no deal. It's just simply both sides already have enough on their plate already to deal with without the added disruption of the UK reverting to trading with the EU on WTO terms.
Okay, so I mean, the issues that you discussed, the fishing, the level playing field, all these sort of things, they're the same kind of issues that have really been plaguing these talks for such a long time. How could we get a breakthrough in something that has been so intractable for so long?
Yeah, well, the optimistic view is that we see a repeat of what happened in October last year. So back then, you know, there's a phone call between Angela Merkel and Boris Johnson, and she was reportedly very direct in her message that the EU would not agree to the technological trade border in Ireland that the Prime Minister was pushing for at the time. So after reacting angrily to the call, you know, Boris Johnson eventually backed down, and then there was that breakthrough meeting with then Irish PM Varadkar, and the deal was subsequently struck on the withdrawal agreement 9 days later.
Okay, and so what's the hurdle then? Is it the politics or the economics that's preventing this breakthrough?
Well, politics certainly factor heavily into the negotiations. So the difficulties of getting an agreement on fishing, you know, is a testament to this, as this industry is a minuscule part of both the UK and EU economies. But the politics and the economics are closely intertwined. So the major sticking point between the two sides seems to be the level playing field issue. So the EU is dead set against agreeing to a regime that would allow the UK to potentially either provide state aid or undercut EU standards at some point in the future in a bid to make UK companies more competitive. So this is all about the EU looking after its economic best interests and not just about politics. So a pathway to a deal could see the two sides structure an agreement in a way that that in fact prevents the UK from deviating from EU regulations, but somehow allows the Prime Minister to sell the deal domestically as one that leaves the UK in charge and doesn't damage his political capital in a way that would be unacceptable to him.
I mean, those seem quite difficult sort of competing objectives. So, I mean, is the situation actually that they're just deadlocked and they're going to remain deadlocked?
Well, yeah, right now they are deadlocked. And it's also worth remembering that the EU is much less incentivized to offer concessions than the UK is. So this is partly due to its size, but also because the EU doesn't want to set a precedent that other countries that want to leave or thinking about leaving the EU will be offered favorable terms. So, you know, the EU wants to have a good trading relationship with the UK, but its primary concern is the integrity of its union. So the negative view would be that Mr. Johnson, he decides that it's not in his best interest politically to cave to EU demands and just can't accept it or just can't accept it ideologically and opts for no deal. But, you know, like I mentioned earlier, I think there's probably good reason to believe there's slightly better than a 50% chance of a deal by the end of the year, despite the two sides still being far apart. Last Tuesday's agreement on the implementation of the withdrawal agreement was good news, and that may have created a smoother path to a deal. So as a part of this deal, the UK government announced that it would drop the contentious parts of the internal market bill that would have given the UK power to override the withdrawal agreement and break international law. So that is really the good news here.
Okay, so there's been some movement then, but there's kind of competing pressures preventing and also incentivizing a deal. I guess those pressures are going to build as we get closer to the economic reality of a no deal Brexit. So what would be the implications of that no deal conclusion?
Yeah, well, back in September, Michael Gove, he warned of the possibility of 2 days delays and queues of up to 7,000 trucks in Kent in the event of no deal. But it's important to highlight that this would be the worst case scenario, not the only way no deal would play out. The EU last week published proposed contingency measures in the event of no deal. And if the UK agreed to these, it would involve essentially keeping current regulations in place for air travel and trucking, which would help avoid a lot of the chaos.
And does that mean then that the difference between a deal and a no deal is actually not as wide as once it was?
Well, a friendly no deal would certainly be better than an unfriendly no deal, but there would still be delays, higher costs, a decline in exports, and a big increase in uncertainty. All this would negatively hurt both the EU and UK economies, but more so the latter. The odds of the UK financial industry gaining so-called equivalence, which are separate negotiations, they would also decline in the event of no deal, whether it's friendly or not.
Okay. And look, I mean, our take on this obviously is not from a political or even an economic perspective particularly, but from an investor's perspective. So what does this mean for the market?
Well, in the event of no deal, the pound would move likely significantly lower. So that would hurt the relative performance of the UK market in common currency terms versus the global equity market. It would also clearly hurt the UK's domestic focus sectors like the real estate companies, financials. UK retailers would also be negatively impacted, not only because they're domestically focused, but their margins would take a hit due to higher import costs stemming from both supply chain disruptions and a weaker pound. The negative impact on the economy would also likely sow more discontent in Scotland and further boosting already growing support for independence there.
Okay. And I mean, so you talked about what kind of movements we could see in the market. I guess the extent of them is going to depend upon the extent to which they're already expected. So what do you think the market is expecting to come out of these negotiations?
To gauge market expectations, we can look at things. We'll look at sentiment, positioning, and implied volatility gauges on the pound. So if we look at CTA recommendations, commodity trading advisor recommendations on the pound, the sentiment's quite bullish. Speculative positioning in the futures and options markets is more or less neutral. Implied volatility on sterling is somewhat above the average of the past 5 years, but not massively so. So taken together, these measures indicate much more optimism now compared to the last time that UK-EU negotiations were at a similar juncture, which was that point in October last year that I highlighted earlier. So for this reason, if we get a deal, we can expect probably just moderate upside in the pound. But if there's no deal, we can expect significantly more downside.
Right. Okay, fine. And then I suppose the other thing is, like, all of that is just assuming that Brexit's almost the only thing going on in the world at the moment. Whereas we know that's obviously not the case by any stretch of the imagination. So how important, how significant is this compared to some of the other factors that might be driving the market?
Yeah, well, it's true that the outcome of negotiations will have a major impact on the UK economy, and to lesser but still meaningful impact on the EU economy. But globally, it shouldn't have a huge impact. How quickly the service sectors around the world can reopen next year as vaccines are rolled out, that'll have a much more meaningful impact on global growth. In the financial markets, the biggest moves coming from the outcome of EU UK negotiations will be in UK domestic stocks, as well as in the pound and to a lesser extent the euro. The global stock market wouldn't like it if there was no deal, but to the extent that this is mostly a regional issue, any global equity market sell-off as a result of no deal should be fairly minor.
Okay, so just finally then, Paul, before we let you go, I mean, just to bring it all together, I guess this is something that people be very worried about. From an investor's perspective, you know, what are the real kind of implications of this potential no-deal Brexit?
Well, I think, you know, the main kind of market implication is that we'd see a weaker pound. And given the FTSE 100, it is so internationally exposed, that weaker pound would certainly provide a lot of support to the FTSE 100 in the event of a no deal, I guess, end to the transition period. The bond market, there's competing forces. You'd see higher inflation expectations on the back of a weaker pound, but at the same time, the market would extrapolate, you know, very low Bank of England interest rates for an even longer period of time than it currently is, which would keep the bond yields fairly well anchored. So I think the main impact would be on the weaker pound, but the UK equity market and bond market would hold up relatively well.
So actually not as bad intuitively as you might imagine for an investment portfolio. Okay. All right. Well, thanks so much, Paul. Really appreciate that sort of whistle-stop tour through what is essentially obviously quite a complex stage in negotiations. Thanks also to all of our listeners. Hopefully you found that useful. Hopefully you found most of our podcasts useful. And we really hope that you'll join us again for another Brewin podcast.